shade to hide the mess that you've made of your mascara. Your piled up hair has all fallen down as the garbage trucks start coming around, picking up trash. Do you think you might ask for a ride? The apartment you left had no number, and the guy you were with had no name. And the sun is up in his wedding martini as you walk the walk of shame. Cab driver, but he don't know either, so you keep walking. The pavement you're pounding feels like your head last night kicked your ass. You're ready for bed. You let a bus pass and a stranger asks, are you okay? The apartment you left had no number, and the guy you were with had no name. And the sun is up, you're sweating martinis as you walk the walk of shame. As you walk,
as you walk,
as you walk the walk of shame.
All right, and that was The Walk of Shame by Truck Stop Honeymoon. Before then, we heard a bunch of songs. We heard Trains I've Missed by Wendell Willkie. I'm making that up, actually. Willy Wonka, Veruca Salt, I Want It Now. Fake Plastic Trees by Radiohead. Push and Shove by Fatboy Slim. Heaven and Earth by Matthew Sweet. Where You Get Love. Where You Get Love by Matthew Sweet. Also, Rub Your Daddy's Lucky Belly by 9-Pound Hammer. AC/DC, You Shook Me All Night Long, Dancing With Myself, Billy Idol, Duran Duran, A View to a Kill, George Thorogood, Bad to the Bone, and we heard Social Distortion, Tom Petty, and started off we heard Red Red Wine by UB40. So, what we're going to do now, I'll tell you a little. The reason we're an hour late, I had a little emergency. Smelled the smell. And it smelled kind of like vinyl smoldering and, you know, not being that bright, it didn't occur to me what it might be. What is that coming from? Thought it was coming from my heater. I smelled it a few days ago, and then, you know, it kind of went away, and couldn't identify the source. Well, today I identified the source, and it was a 3-plug into a 2-plug into a power strip into another power strip, so it's a little overheated and it was starting to melt down. Thank God I was here, otherwise you never know what might have happened, a fire or something. So I got some new power strips and rearranged my electricity so that I trust everything is good. But that's something to be careful of if you smell something that smells like it's burning or melting down. It might just not be a mechanical warmed up grease smell. It might actually be plastic melting. Check all your outlets. Don't plug too many things into other things and then into the wall, I guess is the lesson there. Anyway, let's get this show started. I don't know how long we'll run today. I'm a little unsettled by that and still, unfortunately, I had to reboot and I lost some of my setup, but I've still got a lot of stuff here that we want to deal with. And what we're going to talk about today will be in addition to in-house stuff that we'll start off with, we're going to talk about the death of Bill Buckley and what he meant to conservatism. And we'll discuss an article by Joe Sobran in that relation. We'll also discuss the fraud, the scam that is global warming. And then finally, we'll get into just a little bit of the Oklahoma City. And this time we will do it. I promised it other times, but we have not done it. But I have the book right here. So we will get into that in the final part of the show. I don't know how long we'll run today. Probably a couple hours, though, at least. But now let's start off. We've got a show thread chat, as always, at vnnforum.com in the This Just In section. Always stick it at the top. So go ahead and check there, and if you have any questions or any points you want to make, I'll respond to them. And I think we got about a minute and a half delay on 90-second delay on what you're hearing and what I'm saying. So let's start off with thanks, first of all, to Jimbo in Australia, who sent me Red Over Black. And we've talked a lot about Australia two shows ago on Radio Estina. I think that was February. Let me check it out here. I think it was February 22nd, wasn't it? And we talked about February 14th, okay, yeah, Valentine's Day. And we talked a lot about Australia in relation to the apology made by the Prime Minister to the Aborigines for the so-called Lost Generation, which is greatly overhyped, and it was the taking away of, at most, maybe 10, 20,000 Aborigines, children from their parents and or their parent, and sticking them with white families in the hopes of upgrading them to human level. And what Jimbo has sent me is Red Over Black. It's a book in its ninth printing. This is an older copy. It says it's the chilling and almost unbelievable story of the Marxist manipulation of the Aboriginal land rights movement, told by a man who learned of communist strategy while in the Communist Party. It's a man named Jeff McDonald. And so what we see here is the Jews, just as they did in the U.S., they're using whatever local coloreds they have to strike blows against the white man, and this apology was a big blow. And so once I've read this book, we'll be discussing it further as we educate ourselves about what's going on in our brother country, Australia. So thanks a lot to Jimbo for sending that book. It's just a little it's a little short thing, and I know that he got it from, who puts it out? We also, part of what we're doing here is spreading knowledge about different publishing concerns and publishers that will actually put out semantically incorrect material. This comes from the Veritas Publishing Company, and I think there's a league involved, some kind of political league involved with this, but we'll go into that more next time. Anyway, there was one point that I missed, actually, in that discussion on Valentine's Day 2008 when we were talking about it, and I wanted to go into that before we get into our other material. What that was... we talked about the Jews, describing all the important Jews in Australia who were involved with the so-called civil rights movement there and ending the white Australia immigration policy they had, and in getting rid of the legal, in changing the legal status of Australia before the white man from terra nullis, that is land without people, where in which Aborigines with their 59 IQ were just considered along with the other local fauna and flora, that is animals and flowers. They got that changed in order to put forward the pretense that there had been things like land titles and deeds and registries before the white man. Now, of course, that's not true. But once they get the courts to reverse the terra nullis, they've laid the basis for land claims by the Aboriginals, and today they already own like 10% of the Australian land mass. And there will be further claims. There are many claims pending, and many claims were filed after the formal apology, which I believe was made February 13th, the day before our first Radio Estina of the new year. We did about, I don't know, probably 10, if you include the Linda Radio stuff last year, and I am still archiving those and getting them up to date, and they will be in the one thread at vnnforum.com. And so the part that I missed when we discussed this the first time, and I'm going to do this every show. I'm going to do thanks if there's something to thank people for and do corrections or points that I missed, because I listen to all these shows afterward in an ongoing attempt to improve what we're doing and make it easier and better for you, the listener. And a lot of the improvement comes from simple is technical. It takes a little bit to get used to this, but we have a very easy setup. If there are those of you who would like to do radio, we have our Shoutcast server available pretty much around the clock, except when we're doing shows. So there's plenty of free time for anyone who wanted to get up to speed on this, and all you need is someone to help you set up the Simplecast, and then it's very easy to do. It's just a matter of plugging in a couple of things, and once you have those plugged in, you only have to do it once. You just pretty much hit start and on two different things, and you're on the air. Now, we had referred to a story from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and what I omitted to mention was the last line of this. There's a good example of the double standard that pervades everything Jews put out, everything they believe, and all their behavior. The last line of this story, and let me see here. I think I have this linked. I believe I have this linked at the forum. Again, as I said, you can always find, when I'm talking to you, there's always going to be a show thread, and it's always going to be in this just in, and it's always going to be linked, it's always going to be stickied at the top of this just in, so you'll always know where to place any questions or comments that you have to make in that thread. And let's see, one reason I don't do these shows every day is there actually is a pretty good amount of preparation that's involved, because I'm intending to more or less lecture. I'm not intending to just chat here amiably or play music. I'm here to educate you and provide something that is evergreen. It takes the topics of the day and it puts them in context, and it gives the white man the why. Giving the white man the why is the theme of all the educational media outreach that we do. Now, the article we discussed at great length in the February 14th show, Jews Behind Australian Apology to Abbo Monkeys, is how I titled it. Last paragraph, he says, JTA, Jewish Telegraphic Agency, says, the apology offers no recourse to compensation, although the issue is now being hotly debated. It also reignited the so-called history wars between those who believe the stolen generations were kidnapped in a sinister attempt to breed out their aboriginality, and others who say it was a benevolent attempt to save half-caste children from the ills of aboriginal society. Now, can you guess what I'm going to pick up on there? If you've listened to Radio Estina or Red VNN, you probably can. A sinister attempt to breed out their aboriginality. How about that? Now, when they make sure that it's black on blonde, black next to blonde, and all their porn memes, and all their TV cop shows, and all their advertising circulars, would that constitute a sinister attempt to breed out all of our whiteness? Why, no, they have a slightly different tune for that. They call it diversity, and they say it's our greatest strength. And they work to reverse laws against miscegenation. And those were overturned in the states that had them in the late 60s, I believe in Virginia. I believe Loving was the case. And what do they say when Jews marry out? When Jews try to, through their own choices, breed out their own Jewishness. What do they say? Well, they say they're the vanishing Jew. We're supposed to be very worried about that phenomenon. A prominent Jew, Dershowitz, wrote a book about it. But when we talk about it, we're haters. This sort of double standard is seen across the board. Wherever Jews are, they're pushing double standards like these. There's even a slightly more subtle one. Basically, what you had here was whites operating out of their own fairness and benevolence, trying to help these Aboriginal children who were abused by their parents sexually and physically. And one of the ways they thought they could help them, well, maybe we'll just take some away and stick them with white families and they'll turn into white people. So maybe these whites, these bureaucrats, these government workers were driving off the Jewish big lie that was occurrent at the time, which was that, you know, race doesn't matter. The Jews are the ones who put out that lie through Franz Boas, a Jew from Germany who came to America and founded anthropology as an academic discipline. He put out the lie, race doesn't matter, everything is cultural. Well, maybe these white Australians heard that down there. And they said, okay, well, if we take them away and we show them, we give them a proper upraising by whites, they'll start acting white and they'll intermarry with whites, and there's not that many of them, and we'll breed out their abolition. So you try to do the right thing following the Jewish big lie and you're damned. But if they hadn't taken these kids away, what would the Jews be saying now? They, oh, you neglected them. You don't care about them. You hate them. You let them languish in poverty, and blaming whites for these people being in the condition they had always been in since time immemorial. They couldn't improve their lot because their IQ is, apart from pygmies and Hottentots, in the middle of equatorial Africa, the aboriginal people of Australia, the Munganese, if you may recall, those who listened to the February 14th show, the oldest remains they found in Australia are 40,000 years old. They're called Mungo Man, so I like to call them the Munganese. I think it rolls off the tongue like an untasty grub. The Munganese have IQs that are lower than every other people on Earth, except for pygmies. That's the reason they never develop. There's nothing to blame whites about. Whites in their poor, pitiful, fair, liberal, outreachy kind of way tried to help them, and they're damned if they do, and they're damned if they don't. They're damned up, they're damned down, they're damned sideways, and they're damned around back. That's just how it is when you're dealing with Jews. Jews always blame whites, and they always feed off them. Whites' weakness is that they are they have receptors for guilt. So the Jews plug into these receptors and start pushing the guilt juices into them, and that paralyzes them, and that allows the Jews to feed off of them. It liquefies their resolve, which turns into a hearty protein shake for the Jews to strengthen, to batten upon, to batten and fatten the Jewish tick upon the white body politic, claiming we're the problem. So, yeah, that was something I missed the other time, but note this hypocrisy. It's a sinister if they try to breed out a handful of Aboriginal children and try to make them white culturally and biologically. That's sinister. When the Jew puts little blonde girls next to little niggers and encourages race mixing, knowing that mixed relationships are the most violent out there, what is he doing? Is that not sinister? He's encouraging white women in the way of their destruction. There's nothing more sinister than the Jew, and there's nobody more hateful than the Jew. The Jews are the most hateful people on earth. That's the truth. Now, I'm going to play one song, and then we'll come right back. I'm going to play Mr. Brownstone. I think we forgot to play that to start our show. Here we go.
We'll be right back. 10. Seven women to the huts. If you yell money, if you and who dare to battle in hell. A mercenary.
Okay, that was Jungle Work by Warren Zevon, preceded by Guns N' Roses, singing Mr. Brownstone. And let's see how we're doing here. Alright, looks like our sound levels are okay. And let's move on and discuss an interesting thing. The march in Dresden. There was an interesting article on this. Now, what happened in Dresden was, it was one of the most horrific firestorms ever seen in human history, created by Allied bombers, and they just, for no particular reason other than Churchill's bloodlust, bombed Dresden and created a firestorm that killed tens of thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands. And of course, just as the Jews exaggerate the number of their own dead, they underestimate the number of their enemy dead. So, they don't want you feeling any kind of sympathy for people who are literally burned to death in what is accurately described as a Holocaust. Whereas their own people, most of them, simply emigrated when the Nazis came to power. What the Nazis actually did, as you can see even in the diaries of a Jew, Werner Klemperer, who was a professor during the time, the Nazis passed progressive legal measures against the Jew, and this encouraged them to leave. It's not, now, passing laws against people that are restrictions against them is not the same thing as putting them in a concentration camp and gassing them to death. That didn't happen. But Allied war propaganda that came out of a Jew commie Ilya Ehrenberg's ass is now circulated globally and everyone's made to bow down to it. But it isn't true. There was no Holocaust. There were no 6 million Jews killed. But there were all kinds of Germans burned and broiled to death in the attack on Dresden, and plenty of Germans remember that, and many of them turned up the other day to walk through the street in silent memory of the victims of Judeo-Allied hate. Now, what I'm going to read is an article by a guy named Michael Johansson, appearing in the Western Star, and I believe this is a Canadian paper, and it's just it's an interesting. It shows a little idea of what's going on, and the Germans are pretty organized. They're able to get 5,000-6,000 people out to do kind of a silent march, but an orderly march, and a march with professional banners. And this has the right people worried, because they want Germany eternally looking down and assuming the guilt for things it isn't guilty for, and eternally paying reparations to these endless, endless, endless waves of Holocaust survivors. And as I've said before, a Holocaust survivor just means a Jew over 50, or a Jew who looks over 50. There's not an objective meaning to the word in the least. It's just a Jew's attempt as a parasite to live off others. You are guilty, you are guilty. Never, ever does the Jew pay reparations for what the Jew did to our brethren in Germany or in the Ukraine, where he killed 7 to 10 million, or in Eastern Europe and Russia combined, where he killed tens of millions. Never does the Jew take responsibility for the Jew's acts, let alone pay any reparations to the Gentile countries the Jew has destroyed. And that's what Jews do. They're nation wreckers. Just as certain insects wreck other insects' nations by taking over their colonies or their hives and killing the queen or replacing the queen or putting up chemicals to make the colony think that it's still serving the old traditional queen, Jews are to America, and they use Fox News, they use their access to the president to mislead America, so that America, when it hears Bush, it thinks it's hearing a real American. Well, look, he looks like a real American. He talks like a real American. He's kind of dumb and common folksy. Well, why isn't he a real American? Well, who are all the people behind him? Who are the people who set him up? Who are the people who gave him the money? Who are the people who gave him the plans? Where does all that stuff come from? Well, it comes from Jews. Jews are the major supplier of money to both parties. Both parties. You've had Jewish homosexuals who are the head of the Republican National Committee. Those are the guys who raise the money, do the organizing. How can a Jewish homosexual, I mean, what, or about 1% of them are probably right-wing conservatives, how can they be head of the RNC, or the right-wing party? Well, Jews are behind every party. They don't have a party. Their party is Jews. What's good for Jews is what matters to them. And what matters to them is controlling things. And once they control things, once they own the media, they can suppress alternative views, as they do very effectively in Canada. And part of their suppression is pretending that there weren't atrocities committed against Germans by bloodthirsty Jews and their lackeys like Churchill. But there were, and thousands of Germans turn up to acknowledge that unspoken truth, that tacit reality of this budding new world order they're trying to build. Now let's just read and give you a little sense of what this Michael Johansson thinks. Their numbers were startling and their silence unnerving. Figuring out just how many somber, quiet marchers were winding their way through the streets and over the bridges of Dresden 3 days after the 63rd anniversary of the wartime firebombing of this city, in which around 3,500 people died, was not easy. I have to stop there. That must be a typo. I have not seen any estimate of under 35,000 people dying in the firebombing, and I think others like Irving claim that there were perhaps a couple of 100,000 who died, and if you've seen the photos, they are truly grim photos. Again, there was no military import to this city. It was purely simply destroyed. And they dropped so many bombs. I mean, half the time these Allies were bombing rubble. And enough fire started that it became a literal holocaust. It you know, baked everybody 1,000 degree for, you know, a number of hours, and there's all kinds of people killed. It's almost like Pompeii, where they find the people in ashes. Vicious, nasty stuff. And remember, this is revenge taken against a country whose leader, Hitler, refrained from slaughtering 750,000 British troops, the flower of British manhood that he had penned up at Dunkirk. Think about that. Hitler refrains from slaughtering British soldiers that he legitimately could have killed because it was a wartime and it would have been a legitimate wartime act under international law. Whereas Churchill deliberately bombs a city of no military import in which there are thousands and thousands and thousands of displaced people and innocent citizens, and he burns them to death. Maybe there's a reason that they demonize Hitler as the worst man in all recorded history. And maybe part of that reason is they're trying to cover up what they did themselves, the producers of these shows, the producers of the politics we get today. I tallied the first 100, give or take 2 or 3, and then counted off blocks of 100 until I reached 1,000. That point was about halfway down the procession to where a van mounted with loudspeakers was broadcasting mournful music, which I initially assumed to be at the halfway point of the whole march. I was wrong. After the van, another 1,000 passed, then another and another and another until finally I lost count. My calculated guess is that there were at least 6,000 and possibly many more in the Dresden March, this is. The marchers, men and women and children, most of them wearing black, had come from all over Germany for the event. The flags, banners, and signs they carried proclaimed them to be belong to various organizations with names like the Junge Landmannschaft, Ostdeutschland, the Mecklenburg Action Front, and the National Party of Germany, among others. However, those who came to Dresden not to participate in the march, but to oppose it, had only two names for the people in the street, fascists and neo-Nazis. He says, if these numbers are an accurate indication, then fascism is once again on the rise in Germany. You know, if you object, if you want to memorialize your people who were burned to death for no reason, then you're a fascist. And that's how the left operates, and that's a good source of its strength, is it controls the media so it can simplify the terms that are used, and in the minds of the common people, reduce it to the good people, the progressives, those who love MLK and Annie Frank and the Jews, and the evil bad people who speak against them and tell you the truth about atrocities like this. They're fascists. If they object to their family of civilians being burned to death by Churchill's bombers for no military reason, they're fascists. Okay, they're not demanding any reparations. They're not even really making any overall political point or any direct political point. They're simply memorializing them, walking through the streets, wearing black. But that makes them fascists to the real haters, the leftists who are led, driven, and inspired by Jews. So he says, if the numbers are an accurate indication, then fascism is once again on the rise in Germany, fueled by such things as high unemployment, especially in the East, and a pernicious concern over the failure of immigrant communities, particularly Turks and other Muslims, to integrate into German society. In 2005, when neo-Nazi groups were first accused of hijacking what was supposed to have been a non-political memorial to Dresden's many war dead, using the event to further their extremist goals and to recruit new members to their cause, observers counted less than 3,500 of them. So, the movement seems to have benefited greatly from that first successful hijacking and has repeated its success ever since, with more people showing up each year. The anniversary of the Dresden bombing could have been tailor-made for their purposes. It allows neo-Nazis to dress up the German people as victims of vicious Allied aggression and themselves as pacifists of a sort, with a vow that it should never happen again. I don't know if it allows them to dress up as pacifists. Were they not victims? Of course they were victims of it. The people who manufacture the Churchill myth simply don't have the strength of character, and of course they lack the political interest to portray the truth, which is that Hitler was more moral than Churchill, more merciful. He was simply more evolved. And that generally is characteristic of German society compared to British society. The viciousness and the hypocrisy of Britain have long been noted, and when you throw in on top of that that it's controlled by Jews who suppress freedom of speech, well, that's what you get. Vicious moralizing campaigns that leave nothing but misery in their wake, whether it's in Germany, which is firebombed to death and has all its major cities destroyed, or whether it's in, Serbia, same thing, let's bomb them, because they're not allowing a Muslim state to be planted there. They want to keep their province. Let's bomb them. Let's bomb Iraq. Let's bomb Iran. So this is an interesting phenomenon to watch. You know, they've drawn progressively more people, and apparently they're up to 6,000 this year. So we have photos of VNNforum.com. If you go there, you can find this in our German section or in our general discussion. Also, there's another march coming up we want to talk about just a little bit. I don't know any of the details on this, but I know that it's been a battle in the Czech courts. It says the neo-Nazis are going to march through the Czech city of, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Plzen, Plzen, let's call it, Pilsen or Plzen, on March 1st of this year, 2008. And the mayor had originally tried to ban it, but the court said you have to allow it. Apparently they have some degree of free speech in in the Czech Republic. Plzen mayor Pavel Rodl finally banned the march. However, the regional administrative court decided last Friday that the march was banned unjustly because the criteria for the ban were not met. As a result, Boris could organize a new rally. And so that's where it was. And then the latest is that they're going to have 1,000 policemen to monitor the neo-Nazi march in Pilsen, they're saying. 1,000 policemen will guard the streets of Pilsen during a neo-Nazi march to the city center on Saturday, March 1st, police spokeswoman Jana Vaclavova said. She said riot police, traffic police, detectives and investigators, mounted police, and dog handlers will be on alert since there is a real danger of a conflict arising between the neo-Nazis and their opponents. Now again, it's always the antis who start the problems, because their view is the Marcusean. There should not be any platform for the right. Only leftists should be allowed to speak. Only a leftist should control the press. Only leftists should be allowed to run the government. And anyone who desists or departs from their fantasies needs to be smashed into the ground. And they usually use that verb, smash. Smash the right. Smash the Nazis. Smash the fascists. And they turn around and talk about tolerance. So tolerance is a code word. It means you must tolerate, which really means you must approve what they approve of, and you must disapprove what they disapprove of. So it's not true tolerance. Their use of language is abusive, always. Now that said, I think the next thing we want to move on to is discussing the death of William Buckley and the nature of conservatism, which was brought into some relief in a recent thread at Chronicles of PaleoCon magazine. But you know what? I got to take just a short break here, and we'll discuss that when I come back. And got it all queued up here. And you who think conservatism is something good and Fox News is something good, you're gonna find it interesting what Joe Sobern had to say about it in his article, "How I Was Fired by Bill Buckley." So what should we play? I think we'll play about 3 songs here. Sorry, I'm having a rough day today. It's a rough day, but we're on air and we're moving forward. So I think we'll play. What do I want to play? This will be an interesting selection. Let's see what you think. First up is "The Mob Rules" by Black Sabbath.
Nothing to say. don't say you've gone. Say you've knocked off for a smoker, and you'll be back later on. Hey, true blue. Hey, true blue. Give it to me straight, face to face. Are you really disappearing? Just another dying race. Hey, true blue. True blue. Is it me and you? Is it mom and dad? Is it a cockatoo? Is it standing by your mate when he's in a fight? Or just Vegemite? True blue, I'm asking you. Hey, true blue, can you bear the load? Will you tie it up with wire just to keep the show on the road? Hey, true blue. Hey, true blue. Now be fair to him. Is your heart still there? If they sell us out like sponge cake, do you really care? Hey, true blue. True blue. Is it me and you? Is it mom and dad? Is it a cockatoo? Is it standing by your mate when she's in a fight? Or just Vegemite? True blue, I'm asking you. True blue, is it me and you? Is it mom and dad? Is it a cockatoo? Is it standing by your mate when he's in a fight? Or just Vegemite? True blue. True blue.
In My Dream by Scanners. Before that, we heard True Blue by John Williamson of Australia. And before that, The Mob Rules by Black Sabbath. And now we're back, and we're going to talk a little about William F. Buckley. He died at 82. I guess he was sick, but not on the verge of death. He had emphysema. He's the guy who wrote Got a Man at Yale and founded a review, which maybe some of you listening, like me, grew up reading that in high school, and that was your introduction to the world of intellectual conservatism. And you thought these people were like father figures to you, intellectual mentors, and you thought what they said was true. And you thought they would never lie to you. But as you matured, you realized that men don't come in the good variety. And you realized that they would lie to you, they would mislead you, just as the left would. Although they were honest about many things. Buckley rid the right of anti-Semites and racists. That was his achievement from the Jew point of view. From the white point of view, he gelded conservatism and made it safe for Jews, and therefore ineffectual in doing anything that truly would, in his phrase, stand athwart history yelling stop. No, it stood aside history yelling go, is what Buckley did. Go to the civil rights movement. At one point, actually, his magazine opposed that. They said the mere fact that blacks might be a majority somewhere doesn't mean they should be able to vote civilization out and the jungle in. Of course, he didn't put it like that, but that's what they used to believe. He was saying that in the early 60s, but a couple years later, he switched. He got on the side of MLK being a hero and civil rights revolution being a good thing. And race differences don't matter, and there's certainly no, as we saw the other day in the essay by the black Kenyan conservative, Buckley said there was certainly no biological reason Negroes couldn't be civilized, which of course is untrue. But it is long, long, long been impossible to print any kind of biological cultural fact in National Review. What I remember about it fondly was that back in the 80s when I read it when I was in high school, 80 to 84, you know, I used to go to the high school library at lunch and read National Review and eat some Skittles and really enjoy myself compared to the rest of the day and really learn something compared to the rest of the day. And believe me, the public high schools I went to were far from the worst. But they had erudite writers. They had excellent film reviews, movie reviews. They had policy analysis from very high-level people, and today they've really descended from that so that I don't read National Review and haven't read it for years. I rarely go to their online blog. It's just not interesting. The people that write for them don't know enough to make it worth reading what they say. It's all politics as sports. So Buckley either cleaned up conservatism or he gelded it. There are two ways to look at it. I think the best article ever written about professional conservatism, that is, people who make their living by being conservatives and talking or writing, is by Joseph Sobran, who himself is sickly right now, I believe. But I'll tell you another thing. I happen to know that he's going to appear in Byron Jost's new film. I want you to watch for that. Be coming out this fall. It's called Minority Rule. It's about political correctness or cynical correctness. And I know it has a number of people discussing the Jew and the role of the revolutionary Jew in undermining white society for not decades, not centuries, but millennia. Millennia. One big nasty arc is the Jewish experience as felt, as experienced, as painfully experienced by whites, ordinary whites like you and me. Jews have always been monstrously destructive wherever they have been. Evil outsiders, interlopers, parasites. But I think when someone dies, it's appropriate to take stock of their character. You know, I had a relative die recently. It was ironic in that I went to a funeral the day after I found out that Yankee Jim died, so I kind of thought of him while I was at that funeral. This was my grandmother's older sister, Edith, and she was a good woman. She had a real sharp, really brilliant blue eyes and liked to play cards, and she was 100, actually. She just turned 100, so
the old farm families are dying out. I mean, the Linders and the Sheelys was my grandmother's side, farm families in Adair County, Missouri. And it's funny to read. Let me actually grab it here. I wasn't planning to talk about this, but it's kind of interesting. It shows you how things have changed in America and maybe gives you a little insight. And she had these people who were born in the first decade, about 100 years ago from where we are now. They were born, 1900 to 1915 in there. She was married to a man who died in the 50s. He was actually hit by a drunk driver on a road here, and she never remarried. But just to show you how large families were back then, and this is before the automobile. And these are people living on a farm, and you see the books. Like, my uncle wrote a book about growing up in Adair County, and you see the pictures of all the cousins and everybody, and back in the 50s, they're all tow-headed. They're basically German-type people. Listen to all the relatives she had. They're all dead now. There's one left out of about nine of them that they had. And you see in the Linder and the other side, the families go from like 9 to 8, 9 to 4, 5 to maybe 1, 2, 3, and I bet your family has gone the same way for a lot of you listening to this. That's been the demographic changes that have overtaken whites, and maybe part of that is justified in that we filled in the country to some extent and we don't need that many people working the farm, but ultimately the people who survive in the future are going to be the ones who breed. If you don't like taking care of kids as much as you like watching TV or going on trips, then that's kind of a self-limiting thing. It's kind of like a heterosexual homosexuality. If you only have one or two kids, you're not going to do much more than keep your type around, barely. She had five brothers. This is Edith Marie Jones, my great aunt, as we called her, my grandmother's older sister, who was born in 1908, January 20th, 1908. Died February 17th, 2008. So she and my grandmother's other sister, who lived around Chicago, and my grandmother have all died in the last couple of years. They were 194. My grandma just about turned 5. When Bertha was just about, I don't know what she was, probably late or early 90s. So good stock, I guess we are. We live a long time, unless we're Christianized, like my grandmother, who died early. She got cancer and apparently didn't really do anything about it. Or else she turned to a nurse practitioner, as Christian Science did, and prayed and found it was effective as the niggers, magical pig grease against bullets. That is to say, ineffective. Ineffective. Anyway. And it's too bad. She was an interesting person, my other grandmother. I was about 12 when she died. She was a legal secretary. She knew Latin and could type 100 words a minute and was quite smart. Back then, people didn't have quite so many opportunities as they do today. But from just to show you, five brothers, Woodrow, Lloyd, John, Frank, and Lauren. Only one of them I knew was Lauren. Woodrow died in infancy. That's how it was back then. A lot of people died, or they died of the Spanish flu in 1918 that made its way around the world. I didn't know Lloyd, Johnny, or Frank. Lauren, I knew. He was in World War II, and he was shot by a German sniper, and it was kind of funny. He died a few years ago. He was the one who fought in World War II, and he's like, "We saw one of them panzers coming around them hill, boy, I tell you, took off running. He was going through trees that thick." And he that's more or less exactly the way he told that story. And he got shot in the elbow and messed up his arm by a German sniper. He actually had a Nazi flag that one of my siblings really coveted, but I think he gave it to the Adair County Historical Society. And he also went out, and what he did was, what Lauren did was he would run up the river there at the old Sheely place, which is now owned by a guy, a retired doctor named Gardner, and he had camels out there, believe it or not. And this is actually where Edith was Jones, up at the top of this hill. You go down this long inclined rock driveway to the old Sheely house, and they actually have a natural spring there. They got a little spring house. You go in there and get pure water come up. But Gardner owns that now. But up at the top is a burial ground. It's not the one my grandmother's in, but it's one. There's a lot of Linders and Coy and the other people around here that were mixed in with, the Jones and Swisher and those kind of names. Pretty much I'm, I guess, one of the last lenders left in Adair County now. But, you know, five brothers and then three infancy. So you'll note, out of all these people, five brothers and four sisters, two of them died in infancy. Merle Linder, that was my grandmother, and Bertha Burgles, she died, within the last year or so. All three of them died within the last 2 years. So she is survived by two daughters and two sons. So she herself was of a family of about nine, and then she had four, and then the ones below her have more like two apiece. And that's kind of how America has gone demographically. But she was a good woman, very sharp personality, strong. Miss her. Anyway, how did I get off on that note? I forget. Death, that's what the theme is. And one way you measure people's lives, you know, when my grandmother, you have the, what do you call it, the visitation, the Hudson Plail, Reimer, Davis, whatever the hell it is, a funeral home, and you see all the people and you realize, my gosh, that one person is responsible for, you know, 50 people out of 100 in the room. I mean, they wouldn't exist. I wouldn't exist if it weren't for my grandmother. I wouldn't exist, you know, her kids went to Harvard Law and graduated from MIT and were top corporate executives and were optometrists. This is coming out of a farm family with no particular money or great background, just solid people who happened to be a little more intelligent than average. That was the promise that America had at one point before it became totally Jewed. But you really realize the real power that women have is essentially having kids. Next to that, they're kind of second-rate males in that they can do some things as well or better than males, but they don't really create anything new. The thing that a woman can create is a person. The woman herself is seldom going to display any true originality. She may be able to copy and think very well and follow male established patterns, but the only creative thing she is likely to do, outside of the one in a million exception, is create a life. I mean, if you saw the variety of diversity of personality within my family on the two sides, you would be absolutely amazed. I think whites have a far greater individuality within them for genetic reasons than any other race. Certainly more than Orientals and more than blacks too. Certainly more than Jews, I would say. And it's astonishing, the range. I mean, the side of my family that's Christian Scientist, my grandmother, was all in medical science. I don't know if I told this story before, but what happened to my Christian Science grandmother, they were from California, and they had actually been fairly well off, and they were wiped out in the fire of 06, killed what they had. I think they had a retail store or something. But my grandmother was bitten on the earlobe by a rattlesnake, if you can believe that, when she was about six. And she went into a coma. And nothing they could do would bring her out of the coma. And apparently someone there suggested Christian Science. And so they prayed, and she came out of the coma, and they made the connection between the two. Although it isn't logical. And so that was how they got off the track of being doctors and nurses and medical people into Christian Science. And that's how my mom got into that. And that's how I was raised in it, which had the effect of, you know, the world advances by irony. Irony is the central, or opposition is the central organizing principle of the world. Things so often produce their opposite. It's eerie. The effect Christian Science had on me was making me see that, you know, this just isn't really logical. It's something that's soothing to old women to believe, but you can see right through it. You can see that it's not true. Reality is not what you want it to be. It exists independently. Disease is caused by your mind. Well, your mind can affect your body if your mind isn't your body. I don't know. I don't worry about that stuff. Your mind is affected when you have a toothache, so it must be pretty darn closely connected to your body if it's not your body. You can't think straight when you're in great pain.
That's me. Now, trying to see if we've dropped off here or what. Okay, there we go. The green levels were a little low. But, you know, the belief in it became clear to me at a very young age that there are people out there who believe, truly believe, that reality is what you make it with your mind. I would say you can take whatever attitude you want towards it, but reality exists independently. And that belief, and that is my fundamental belief, that reality exists and that it can be perceived and accurately, is the base of my philosophy. And when you start from there and you start with facts, and this is the inductive approach as opposed to the deductive approach, when you start with the facts and you let this, the theory or kind of, or the generalization kind of percolate upward from them or emanate from them, it's pretty hard to go wrong. And you know, this plays into what Orwell said. It's difficult to notice what's right in front of your nose because you're always tempted to rely on what's behind your eyes, you know, your little conception of how things should work or even do work, but actually don't work because you don't verify it often enough. So Christian Science had the perverse effect of making me into what you might call today a race realist, or just a realist in general, a factualist, someone who's interested in trying to perceive things correctly and go from there, not someone who hates the world or imagines it should be vastly different, but someone who tries to understand what is possible and what is actually going on, and where the two meet, and what you can do. And so, having made all these points about dead people, dead relatives, and the effects they had, I mean, that's what effect did William F. Buckley have on the world? You know, that's, I guess, and there was no connection originally, but now that I've talked about it, I see the connection is that this interest in fact is what made the right-wing publication National Review so appealing to me as a teenager. I could see it was much more than the childish slogans batted about in my high school or from the leftist. I could see they were telling the truth about things because they didn't smear other people. They went to the facts. And we'll discuss that later when we talk about global warming. But what kind of a man was Bill Buckley? I think the best answer is given by Joseph Sobrin in his pamphlet written a few years ago, How I Was Fired by Bill Buckley. I've discussed before, but that's okay. It's worth rediscussing in light of Buckley's death, his demise. And the upshot, I always like to sum things up for you, is that Buckley truckled before the Jews. He was in favor of big government, and he was in favor of big government dominated by Jews doing whatever was necessary to protect Israel. And anyone who made him look bad in front of the Jews, who provided most of his writers and his money, because all these publications run in the red, and they have to have their deficits made up by grants from foundation, anyone who threatened that by reporting too much of the truth, Buckley got rid of. And when he got rid of them, he implied they were crazy and they were morally wrong, which is just the thing the Jews do in the Soviet Union. But we need to talk, and let's read a little of what Sobrin has to say. Think about it. Maybe I should just read the whole thing. It's not really that long. He says, in October 1993, I was fired by National Review, Joe Sobrin says. The magazine I'd written for since 1972, so 21 years after he's hired in 72, he's fired in October of 93, 15 years ago. It was unexpected. Buckley had threatened to fire me a couple of years earlier, and he writes in his book, In Search of Antisemitism, Buckley wrote about 50 books, that he nearly fired me on another occasion, of which I'd had no inkling. So this time, when I read a critical and disputed his account, it was a near certainty that the axe would fall. Since my firing, Bill has privately circulated a selection of private correspondence, some of it deeply affected my heart. My columns are... Think about that. I have only one real quarrel with it. It's not in chronological order. This has the effect of making me look like a hypocrite for professing affection while publicly attacking him. So this is a guy that, you know, he's so genial, he's so accommodating to the Jews, but he has this other side that his most trusted subordinates and colleagues get to see if they do anything that might damage his esteemed eyes, the Jews, who either fund him or are in position of power over him to where they can threaten him and his income, and his public stature. Does he side with the truth? No. He cuts private letters to make his own friend and his own employee, who started thinking he was practically a god, to make him look bad. That's not the action of a man of high character.
an ability. It's the action of a typical common garden slug. It's dirty. The critical facts are that my letters and columns praising him were written before. In one case, years before I saw his book, or had any clear idea of contents. Any reader notices the dates on the various pieces, see this for himself. The time I praised him, I assumed he was incapable of anything treacherous. And that's exactly the right word. What Buckley did is trick. It's disingenuous of him to use what I wrote before this book was published as evidence of my inconsistency, let alone hypocrisy, when the book itself changed my view of him so radically. So Buckley's taking letters to praise and pretending they were written before he wrote this book, dumping on Sobrin and other people he calls anti-Semites. To put it bluntly, if you betray a man, you have the right to claim he isn't as nice to you as he used to be. That's the special nature of betrayal. It kills me in a friendship. It doesn't mean that you aren't still the man you were before, but you certainly have the same friend you were before. Bill is probably smart enough to figure this out. His book wrote a number of things about me that were shaded in a way that made him look better and me worse than the way I recalled it. I wrote at the time that I'd be giving my version soon, but I put it off a while, knowing my version would probably be the end of many years at National Review, and I had them hard before precipitating that. When I was employed there, these people don't make huge sums of money. Bill and I had been good friends for most of 21 years I'd worked for him, but the friendship was strained in 1970. I'm sorry, but the friendship was strained in 1986 when he took the side of my attackers in a row over Israel. Norman Poritz and his wife, Jadetta, accused me of anti-Semitism. Bill had a weird public avowal of my columns on Israel, saying in effect that I wasn't anti-Semitic, but deserved to be called anti-Semitic. This obeyed me, he didn't believe what he was saying. It was a failure of nerve. A failure of nerve. That was clear even from the disavowal itself, which included a slight digression on Jewish retaliatory power. Failure of nerve, you know, it's interesting. I saw William F. Buckley speak when I was in college, and his concluding line, and he concluded to great applause, was, you know, they will be glad that the blood of their fathers ran strong. That's the public face. Private, he's just scared shitless of the Jews. Scared enough to dump on one of the finest commentators of our generation, Joe Sobrin, his own employee and friend for over 20 years. This is the character of William F. Buckley. So you see, in time, all of our gods are revealed to be frauds, or have feet of clay, or hearts of rabbits. Earlier that year, he'd taken me to dinner to warn me of the danger of being, quote, perceived as an anti-Semite. His book sounded like a long campaign to set me straight, but it wasn't like that at all. Bill didn't suggest I'd done anything wrong or that he disagreed with anything I'd written. That was enough. Later that evening, I told Bill about some Irish Catholic fan who told me they hated me. He sneered. You don't know those people. Bill denies having said this. I was fired for quoting it. But he said it all right. In itself, it would be a small thing, but it describes his own policy. Ignore the Catholics, cultivate the powerful. Just try to imagine him writing a book against abortion. I continued my wicked ways, criticizing Israel and the U.S. In May, the Zionist apparat went public in its smear against me, throwing that view into a total panic. There was a senior editor's disgust. The disavowed and prepared behind my back. This is classic WASP. Classic WASP. This was the first I'd heard of it. Bill's statement didn't even mention the Podhoritzes by name, as if he were protecting their anonymity. Every other publisher of the incident on both sides spoke freely of the Podhoritzes' role, but for some reason, National Review tried to pretend nothing to do with it. But basically, they're pretend they're not being scared and intimidated into dumping their finest commentator in the magazine. That's how gutless WASP Bill Buckley is. Gutless. Utterly gutless. Furthermore, all responses from the magazine's readers, overwhelmingly on my side, were suppressed. Think about that. What could be Jewier than shading letters to make your friend look bad, whether they're his own letters or whether they're letters written by the people paying to read his material in your magazine in support of him. I mean, that's utterly dirty. Utterly dirty. Those who fawn, you know, the fool you flatter is the fool you become. The kike you fawn over is the kike you become. You flatter the kikes, you try to cultivate the powerful, rich kikes, you start acting like them. You start acting dirty. Ignobly. And that's what's going on with William F. Buckley Jr. And boy, how brilliantly, how beautifully Joe Sobrin lays this out. Best thing ever written about professional conservatism and what's really going on behind the scenes. And for that reason, I am going to read it all. And I just like reading it, and I think you need to hear it all. And Let's see. So he says, furthermore, all responses from the magazine's reader were suppressed, and the readers were overwhelmingly on the sober side. That is, just as we said, as the internet reveals today, whenever you allow free responses to columns, we so-called anti-Semites, haters, extremists, racists dominate. Why? Because the facts are on our side, and most people are more or less factual in their orientation to the world. At least most people interested in politics more or less perceive what's going on. So they have to lie, have to control, they have to smear, they have to do dirt behind the scenes in order to stay on top. A couple years later, says Soberin, when the Podhoretzes accused Russell Kirk of anti-Semitism, the National Review was the only conservative publication that didn't even report it. So again, letting the kikes bash their own people and pretending it's not happening or else going along that Russell Kirk is like one of the founding guys of the 20th century. He wrote the, what did he write? Did he write the conservative mind? I think he compiled that, wrote it. Yeah. So, one of the two top minds, you know, of the top kind of intellectual conservative of the 20th century is shat on by the Podhoretzes and the other Jews, and National Review does nothing about it. They ignore it. They pretend it's not happening. I couldn't understand what the fuck was that. I merely applied conservative principles, says Soberin. The things National Review stood for, it was a socialist country with no limited constitutional right, which discriminated against Christians while becoming a benefactor of the United States and turning the Muslim world against us. It seemed to cut me, and the reasons conservatives gave for supporting Israel made much sense. Nobody really disagreed with me. That, in fact, was a problem. That creates more awkwardness than saying people can't afford to admit they agree with. Disagreement is manageable. It's agreement that wreaks havoc. If people disagree, they'll debate you. If they secretly agree with something but are furious for saying it, then they'll shut up by any means necessary. As Tom Stafford puts it, I agree with every word you say, but I will fight death to your right to say it, i.e. liberals on niggers. They know that niggers are niggers, but they don't want you talking about it. They want you to play off their game of pretend. They're political Christian scientists. No, our society isn't really sick. There's not really giant growing brown blotches of cancer everywhere you look. No, it's not happening. It's not happening. Just praying about diversity and how great it is, and it's going to save us. Just look at Obama. You see the insanity that runs through the white section of humanity, the white race? That's what has to be weeded out, or at least have power taken away from it. Everything about the uproar puzzled me. After all, I was and am a columnist, not a political leader. I sit alone in a room and I think I hope will make sense to someone out there. I don't ask readers to accept things on my own authority. I appeal to what is already publicly known. And in that sense, it's very much like William L. Pierce, who would say, you know, look, don't believe me. Go check it out for yourself. Verify what I'm telling you. And we say that, too, at VNN. We always say that. That's what an honest man does. He doesn't clap people in jail for dissension, for holding dissenting opinions, for making arguments. He says, go verify what I'm saying. What the left does is smear. It smears, smears. There's only two ways to approach things, either factually, in which you discuss things and you puzzle out what's going on, or you attempt to put something over on people. To do that, you have to lie. And to lie, since you have nothing to back yourself up, you have to mischaracterize your opponent's motives, and you have to smear him and his mind and his character. And if you really have to, then you got to throw him in jail. Like the 30 men we have listed in our still-growing free speech martyrs forum. Country after country in Europe throws men in jail because the powers that be don't want them telling the truth about stuff. So what difference did it make what my motives were? Suppose Podhoretzes could know what they were. Either my 700-word arguments, that is, his columns, made sense, or they didn't. Why should anyone get excited? Well, I go to such lengths to prove that if you like to read arguments, read mine. But Bill acted as if it were life and death matter. With Bill's statement, National Review became, by default, the sort of magazine. It had virtually announced that its vowed principles didn't apply to Israel. One standard for the Jews, another standard for the rest of us. One standard for Israel, another standard for every other nation. And that its conservatism had no real separate existence from that of commentary. That's the Podhoretzes magazine. Or the public interest, another one that's edited by Jews. We, in fact, were scooping National Review with feisty analytical journalism. It's what you're to agree with, especially along with the power of Zionists of Manhattan, that it wouldn't even defend its own from smears. Its own being Kirk and Soberin. So eager to curry favor with and get along with the power Zionists of Manhattan. Well, when we say Jews control media, that's what we mean. That's part of what we mean. The most telling issue today was the Pollard case. Conceived in preoccupation with his Chambers case, the magazine couldn't bring itself to condemn Israel for Jonathan Pollard's espionage,
It demanded the death penalty for Pollard, but an amnesty for those who had recruited him and paid him. Moreover, it showed no interest in whether the military seeks parts of Israel had been passed on to the Soviet Union, as some reports had it. Here was the his case of the right, and some conservatives were evading the critical questions just as the Soviets' liberal partisans in this country had done generally. That's the liberals in this country denied, 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 and lied that Alger Hiss was not a communist agent, when in fact he was. He was like the one non-kike commie agent. And for that reason, I really believe he became kind of the symbol for the whole thing. I think Nixon said something like, yeah, he was basically the only one of the whole rotten group of subverters in the U.S. that wasn't a Jew. Alger Hiss was actually of German descent. They usually call him a WASP of German descent, and he went through the usual WASP channels, though. What the silence of most conservatives exposed was not disloyalty or treason, but insincerity. All their patriotic words were empty. That's my favorite quote document. It was all a game or way of making a living. It was all a game or a way of making a living. It was all a game or a way of making a living. That's what professional conservatism is. It was all a game or making a living. Friend, what am I going to find in the pages of National Review? It was all a game or a way of making a living. Friend, what am I going to see in Fox TV News? It was all a game or a way of making a living. What do I get when I'm listening to Limbaugh and Hannity? It was all a game or a way of making a living. What do I get from it? It was all a game or a way of making a living. What am I going to get from Matt Dre? It was all a game or a way of making a living. That's what professional TV, mass media, trash media, conservatism is. It was all a game or a way of making a living. A game, a way of making a living. A game, a way of making a living. They say what they got to say to keep food on their table. Oliver North even said that. What does the truth get you? The truth never put any food on anyone's table. The Jews have the power. And the whites truckle before them. Whites like William F. Buckley. Other whites who have guts don't. They fight the Jews. Real conservatives fight the Jews. They don't exceed in their big lies any more than they exceed in their firebombing campaigns to destroy innocent people, whether German civilians, Iraqi civilians, or Serbian civilians. We fight them. Looking back, I think I felt a strange subterranean anger from Bill Dingham about that time. He didn't want to tell me how angry he was because I was on the right. And it's obvious things that he didn't have the courage to say. It was extremely frustrating to try to argue with him because he would neither disagree nor concede anything. He would nitpick, change the subject, accuse him of anything but say whether Israel were the ally of the U.S. I guess it's classic WASP behavior. Classic WASP behavior. What I define as WASP is fear of losing social status by taking the wrong position on something. One doesn't do such things. Really, one doesn't do such things like tell the truth about Israel. One just pretends. And this is the defining moment, really, of... It's defining behavior of... I wouldn't say moment. It's defining behavior in Bill Buckley's life that he was willing to throw his friends to the wolves, keep his social status. What he cared about more than anything was that he be seen as this cool, conservative guy who was really funny and friendly, and the liberals could do business with him. Why could they do business with him? Well, he gave up. He surrendered. He compromised the essential elements of conservatism. And he abandoned his friends. That's William F. Buckley Jr., now in the grave. Once he wrote that I was prayed over at National Review, and I just said the other editors were not merely intellectual, but spiritual. I could just picture editorial meetings in my absence with those present, willing to seek Almighty to God's strength. Back to the editorial consists on Israel. And then a classic. Phil Musgrave Penthouse's most prayerful contributors. That is the touch of the master. And I remember the first time I read that, just fucking, I was like laughing. And I didn't roll on the floor laughing. I bumped through my fist. Yeah, that's something. The knife is in it. He gives it a twist. I mean, that is just beautiful. That's as well done as it can be. Trust me. That's as well done as it can be. Bill Musgrave Penthouse's most prayerful contributors.
I hope you don't mind a little short on my part.
When I wrote Poems on Israel, Bill would write peevish notes,
saying I was obsessed. Now, wow, what an interesting coincidence. He uses precisely the same word that the Jews use whenever someone starts examining their interests rationally.
Wait, why are you so obsessed with the Chosen? They work hard, they educate themselves. I mean, they arrive at these positions, not only for me. I mean, it's a very bad actual ability.
You know, why are you obsessed with Jews? Why are you obsessed with this country that takes a chance in exchange makes us hated by every nation on earth?
Why are you so obsessed with the Jews? Tiny and wonderful people. Caring and highly ethical people. Sometimes they have a little stomach pain, but it's only from caring too much.
I had my own view on which of us was obsessed. Once he retracted a column on the Gulf War back in 91. He took as implying that he was in fact working for Israel. I not only hadn't implied such a thing, I hadn't mentioned him. And I hadn't even been thinking of him when I wrote the column in question. In fact, the idea was so bizarre, it had never occurred to me, and I was baffled and furious. I thought he was looking for an excuse to get rid of me. I saved my bacon by writing a, quote, retraction, unquote, whose irony escaped him. But I realized my days at the magazine were... I came close to quitting several times. John Sullivan talked about it once, and once Bill and I had sharp words, I needed to learn the difference between an employee and a serf. He backed off a while, but pretty soon he resumed dropping me emissions about constant like, this is such utter gullessness. Here he has a guy who is, if not the best columnist of his generation, as I believe Patrick Cannon, himself a fine columnist, called him, certainly in the top five. Someone with a genuine knowledge of the men, the mindset, and the generation that produced the Constitution, and a true and thorough understanding of what the Constitution actually meant to people who created it. That's a rare and valuable thing. This is someone, and not only did he have a genuine academic knowledge of the subject, having a PhD in it, he had a flair for words, or has a flair for words. He's still alive, Joe Sobrin. That is pretty close to unique. There are few better than Joe Sobrin when it comes to turning a phrase or creating a nice insight. And as we've seen, he can also be quite funny, and those are far rarer than people with PhDs who are intelligent, in my opinion. Once I wrote a column about the strange fear of Jews I found among people who publish with him. Bill wrote me about that one. I had him in mind. See, he's getting that paranoia, man. He's starting to think like the Jews. Everyone's out to get me. Everyone hates me. Well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Jews are like people with feelers. It's that their feelers are invisible, but they have that quality. You can kind of see it in their eyes and their small actions, their micro actions, show people who are not particularly comfortable in skin and are always looking around to see who's noticing them. That time he was partly correct. He was afraid that people would know I was alluding to him. Well, at least he didn't use his name, which is more consideration than he should meet. And then I thought, gee, why all the fuss? I was just a writer. I was to be left alone to write for my little public. Nobody was forced to read me, and my views didn't be swaying public policy. But here was Bill trying to put pressure on me behind the scenes, and he wasn't the only one. The Washington Times under intense pressure did my column. Remember here the parallel to St. Francis. Anyone who writes truthfully or factually about Israel or race, why, the Zionists want to get rid of him. They don't want him writing that stuff. He's an evil racist, hater, anti-Semite. He must be gotten rid of. So did my syndicate. So the Jews are pressuring not only the Washington Times, but they're pressuring Sobrin's syndicate to get rid of him. Dump him, dump him. He's not towing the line on Israel. Get rid of him, get rid of him, get rid of him. And people out there think that we have a free media. That's why I do this show, to teach you the truth about the media. I think last radio with Tina, we talked about Kevin MacDonald, and he said just that. Most people think, you know, that all the issues out there are debated by the finest minds in America and that we have a perfectly free press and everything comes under scrutiny. Not the case. In fact, quite the opposite. There's a party line on all the major issues, and they essentially keep out of the papers and off TV anyone who has a contrary view to the establishment. And the establishment essentially means these rich Manhattanites that Sobrin is talking about, the ones who scared Bill Buckley, who intimidated him out of his better senses into crapping on his friend and actually throwing him the wolves. That's not Aryan behavior. That's cowardly behavior. So those of you who think we have a free media, this is a good article to refer people to. You can't write the truth about Israel or race, or the Zionists will gang up behind the scenes to put pressure on your syndicate and your newspaper to dump you. In early 1990, as I recall, Bill told me he was writing an, quote, essay on anti-Semitism, unquote, and asked my subject. Thinking he might have known what I thought of him, a long memo, he neglected to tell me that I was one of his targets, that he might use for the purpose of quoting against me. Another bit of incredible dirtiness, nastiness. You just don't do that. You don't do that, not to someone that it was your employee and your trusted friend. His most talked about piece of writing in years. When he put, what he put him do me any harm? But I've appreciated this to Burnborn before going to all the trouble for him. I mean, how duplicitous can that be? That's why they say perfidious Albion. The English are often like that. Bill's essay, it later became the first chapter of his book, consumed the entire Christmas issue of National View. His attack on Pat Buchanan naturally got far more attention than his milder remarks about me. Coming during Pat's presidential campaign, it did terrific damage and created lasting bitterness among conservatives. The whole essay and book defies paraphrase. Book never defines anti-Semitism, and he compounds the confusion by writing a prose refined of such coarse elements as nouns and verbs. But most readers thought, and the funny thing here, and I don't know if he says it in this piece, but he independently of me, came up with exactly the same thing. He thought, and I wrote this, I don't know if I wrote this before or after he wrote it, but we both wrote exactly, I mean, literally exactly the same thing. That extended to say anti-Semitism that occupied, you know, the whole issue of the magazine, and later was published as a book. It had exactly the feel of a note written by a man with a gun to his head. That was exactly what I felt when I'm like, wow, this is just incredible. I mean, this fear was palpable. The pages were almost dripping with sweat, pouring off Buckley's neck, keeping that stiff British Anglo-Wasp upper lip. He did not. This is his character. Going crabwise under pressure, if I might steal a phrase from the late Hunter S. Thompson. Going crabwise under pressure. Don't do it. So just to repeat the one sentence, he says, check my levels here. How are we doing? How are we doing? Are we on? He says, let's see. The whole essay and book defies paraphrase. I mean, Bill never defines anti-Semitism, and he compounds the confusion by writing a prose refined of such coarse elements as nouns and verbs. Now, what if people? Why would someone do that? Why would someone who knows how to write and has written 50 books write like that? Well, because there's only one reason. A man who knows better only writes obscurely for one reason. He has to hide what he truly thinks. He feels he cannot say what he truly thinks. And that alone, if you ever find yourself in that position, you need to ask yourself, what is going on here? What has made me so afraid that I can't express my feelings directly in the appropriate words? That is, simple nouns and verbs. What is it that I can't put baldly that has me so fearful that I must obscure my true meaning and instead secrete bilge like a squid secretes ink to hide myself as I escape? But most readers thought Bill's dragging his father's anti-Semitism into the piece plumbed new depths, even for the era of Mommy Dearest genre. After all, nobody is easier to expose to the public obloquy than your parents. Unless they desert you, you are likely to know a lot about them, and some of it unflattering. Most of the human race considers it ungracious to take advantage of them. One of Bill's recent books was titled Gratitude. Another touch of the master. Touch of the master, man. This stiletto goes right up under the rib. Right into the heart. Oh, that's beautiful. So he's this is a master, and this is about as far as people with great deal of self-control who live around colleagues and want to get along. This is about as far as they ever go and just taking direct jabs at each other. And, you know, he's pointed out that when he's not writing for Penthouse, Bill's praying for Joe Subrin's soul. And when he's, you know... when he's not ratting out his parents as anti-Semites, he's writing books about gratitude. Again, I chortle. I think it's worth chortling. Again, this is the character of the late and, in these quarters, unlamented William F. Buckley. I met him after his speech. They had a receiving line, and I shook his hand, and I gushed, you know, oh, I like your magazine. It's taught me a lot. He was, you know, charming to me and nice, friendly, same brilliant smile and light blue eyes. That's how he made his way through the world. Little did naive young Mr. Linder know that this kind of stuff was going on behind the scenes. That someone he respected and thought was a real titan of intelligence and understanding and leadership, in fact, was merely a man. and a man who is scared of the Jews who actually run America. It would take me a while longer to learn that.
I think it tells you something about Bill's real attitude toward Jews, that he thinks the way to propitiate them is by offering up a member of his own family. Isaac sacrificing Abraham, so to speak. That is, the son sacrificing the father, as opposed to the father sacrificing the son, as in the Old Testament. Actually, it smacks of the Soviet era, when children were urged to inform on their parents. Nothing was private. Bill's own attitude reminds me of the way Stalin was regarded. Public fawning, private dread. Isn't that the truth? Now, Bill didn't really say anything very bad about either Pat or his father, because he didn't really say anything, period. His late style has declined into something approaching pure gesture, and meaning tends to get lost in it. All he really did to Pat, Will, Buckley, and me, was to juxtapose us with the word anti-Semitism, which is in itself enough to create a foul impression, no matter what the logical and syntactical ligaments may be. Bill himself used to be accused of anti-Semitism and even Nazism, which ought to have been something about loose charges. But he learned the long lesson. He learned the best way to be safe from them is to make them yourself. When he caught on to that, he was like a kid with an annoying new toy, a noisy gun that he points at everyone. You're an anti-Semite. You're an anti-Semite. You're an anti-Semite. You're all anti-Semites. I'm the only non-anti-Semite here. In his essay, he continued to avoid mentioning Podhoretz's role, and he refrained from judging their conduct toward his fellow conservatives. In fact, it transpires in the responses to his first essay that he'd made a backstage deal with Norman Podhoretz. He'd made a backstage deal with Norman Podhoretz to prevent me from writing about Israel and related Jewish topics. So here's Buckley saying to this ugly pile of chicken schmaltz, yeah, okay, I understand him. I will never allow this brilliant man to ever write about Israel or question it in any way in the pages of my magazine. It will not happen. I swear to God, it will never happen. Never again. I was wrong to allow it, and I won't allow him. I really want to apologize for what I allowed Joe Sobrin to write. I know it was very mean and vicious and anti-Semitic. I will never let him write anything in the pages of my National Review ever again, okay? Can I keep coming to your parties and you keep helping me and you won't trash me in public, please? 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 I mean, this is not the behavior of a man. This is the behavior of a coward. As Joe Sobrin says, imagine giving another editor that kind of control over his magazine. And imagine letting such an arrangement become public knowledge. Why not just put Norman at the top of the masthead, for Christ's sakes? I added that, for Christ's sakes. Sobrin respects Christ, I don't. The finished book turned out to be as turgid as the first essay, except for the parts where others' replies were printed. I wrote a reply myself, and much of the rest of the book was Bill's attempt to belittle my arguments without meeting them. He didn't have the honesty to concede that I'd made any valid points about our alliance with Israel. It was one long act of appeasement. How many times have I said, this is what we must be called as people, appeasers and collaborators? You know what would look good on Ann Coulter? A shaved head and a face full of spit. Because she's a goddamn appeaser and a collaborator with Israel, our enemy. And that goes for all of them. And it goes for the late, unlamented William F. Buckley Truckley Jr. Trucklin' Bill Buckley, that's what we'll call him. It was one long act of appeasement, aimed only on the good side of the Zionist apparat, back on the good Zionist apparat. The book may have done Bill some good, but it didn't do the Jews any good. Treating fanatical Zionists like the Podhoretzes as normative Jews is no favor to Jews. You could even argue that it's an insidious form of anti-Semitism, that is, taking the Podhoretzes as norm. Here I actually somewhat disagree with Sobrin. I think they are fairly normal. They're certainly the type of people that Judaism always coughs up to lead itself. So they can't be too far from the norm. The book was written in a sort of nervously meandering prose that sounded as if the author had a gun at his head. Now see, there he says, that's exactly, in those exact words, what I thought when I read it and wrote it in print. It should have come with a ransom note. Exactly. In other words, the book is written in fear. Nothing in it suggests any appreciation of Jews, any savoring of distinctive Jewish qualities. Its real message is not that we should like or respect Jews, only that we should try not to hate them. But this implies that anti-Semitism is the natural reaction to them. Yeah, as I've said many times, anti-Semitism is the natural reaction of the human to the Jew. It's a line. It's worth repeating. If it's universal sin, after all, it must be a universal temptation. If people are taught that Jews are hated everywhere, they are not going to draw the conclusion that it's always the Gentiles' fault. But this doesn't occur to Bill. When he defends Jews, I sometimes feel like saying, Bill, it's all right. They're not that bad. Well, in fact, they are that bad. Though Bill professed concern for the survival of the Jews, it was his own survival he was worried about. What he told me on the disputed winter night back in 1986 was not that my columns on Israel threatened the Jews, but that they threatened my own future. And thanks to him, that turned out to be partly true. But the Podhoretzes could never have hurt me the way he did. I felt betrayed by that book and by Bill's general conduct on the Jewish issue. But there was more to it than that. His mind had lost its edge. I kept waiting for it to come to his senses, not only in Israel, but on other things, too. I thought the whole conservative mission was to reduce government, to rationalize it, unquote, as he once finally put it. And that's a line way in that Black Kenyan essay, those who can use it responsibly. If you think rationally, you'll recognize the limits of those who can use it responsibly, where they lie, as he once finally put it. But he was getting further and further from the great old state haters of his youth, Mencken, Albert J. Nock, Frank Chatterow, John T. Flynn, and going off on benders like writing a book in favor of national service, that is, slavery. Finally, it became obvious he wasn't going to change. He's old, he's set in his ways, and his mind isn't going to come up with anything new. His preoccupation seems to be protecting his celebrity. Yes. That's the WASP's desire for status that makes them fawning hypocrites. When you see the red carpet at the Oscars and you see the reaction, you see the way the actors act to the people interviewing them, that's classic WASP behavior. What can I say? Look around and see who's looking at whom. What kind of a figure am I cutting in public? Measure my words against their immediate reception. Say what will make me look good. That's how I want to be. That's classic. It's not just WASP, it's British. That's British culture, and that's a very, very negative thing. There are lots of negative things about British culture, but they're not the ones that it's usually blamed for. That's why I'm here, though. That's why I'm here. Pointed out what is actually wrong with our British culture. And this sort of status-seeking cowardice, pretty close to the top of the list. Remember that Jared Taylor wants to be the William F. Buckley of racialism. He wants to geld it by kicking all the anti-Semites out, just as Bill Buckley kicked the anti-Semites out of conservatism, thereby paving the way for the neocons to take it over and the country and our money and our son's blood in their war to expand Israel. While Jared Taylor wants to do exactly the same thing the late and unlamented Truckland Bill Buckley did for conservatism with white nationalism, claiming Jews are white, for Christ's sakes. So he says that Buckley's preoccupation seems to be protecting his celebrity. That was what I threatened. He was afraid charges of anti-Semitism against me, no matter how unfair, would hurt him. It was his duty to avoid being accused. In his mind, the accusation itself constituted guilt. Early in 1993, I heard that he'd spoken on anti-Semitism to a Jewish group and had mentioned me. The next time I saw him, I told him to leave my name out of these affairs. You started it, he said. I could only guess that he meant I started it by getting myself accused of anti-Semitism. I'd certainly given him nothing but loyalty for 20 years. Now he thought he owned the right to abuse my name. He was telling me he had no intention of stopping. At about the same time, he sent another note about my column. I'd twitted George Will, one of his pals, known as a lapdog, for his submission to the Zionists, his licking of their hands. Fortunately, I can't blame him for being a WASP because he's of German descent. And Bill wrote that I shouldn't do this because Will was on our side, unquote. I had to stop and reflect on how Bill defines our side. His our side seems to include a Podhoretz, but not a Buchanan. Like most of Bill's communications, this had a wry interest as a self-revelation. He still thought, in spite of everything, that he was my respected mentor. This summer he wrote an especially contemptible essay on Muslims, arguing crudely that terrorism is encouraged by the Quran itself. I knew where he got that stuff. It was right out of the Zionist agitprop manual. I was reading the same sort of thing in the New York Post, the New Republic, and such like rags. I wondered who'd clipped the Quran for him. I doubt he's ever opened it in his life. Citing the injunction that wives obey their husbands, and apparently unaware that St. Paul says the same thing,
that is, Christians take the same line, Bill suggested that this explains the miserable plight of women in the Islamic world, adding humorously, to all appearances, the only time men and women get together in Islamic society is when they copulate. And, of course, Sobrin uses the humorously, ironically there. He's showing you to what depths Buckley has fallen. The clear purpose of that column was to suck up to his buddies, nothing else. Bill doesn't even hate Muslims enough to wish to offend them. He was doing it only to curry favor with the neocon crowd. Just like Ann Coulter. Think of William F. Buckley Jr. and Ann Coulter as a couple of wasp, craven, servile, fawning, crawling, appeaser, collaborator, Ken and Barbie. And you won't be more than 1% wrong. He was doing it only to curry favor with the neocon crowd, with a touch of gutter humor showing how far he was willing to go. An abject performance. So much for his pose as the right's scrupulous foe of bigotry. And so it is with Jared Taylor. You can say anything you want about Muslims. You can make any anti-Muslim jibe you want at Free Republic or Amran, but you can't cite any facts about Jews. You can't make any factual observations about the evil that Jews do. Again, this is the work of trucklers. And Jared Taylor, like William F. Buckley, is a wasp and an appeaser. A collaborator with the Jews who are undermining our Western white world. So much for his pose as the right scrupulous foe of bigotry. You know, one thinks of the little Jew, Michael Hart, running down the aisle, shrieking curses at David Duke for asking a simple question, and of Jared Taylor saying nothing about the undignified display of one of his pet Jews. Too funny, isn't it? He was telling Norman Podhoretz, in effect, whom thou smearest, him also will I smear. Israel, he wrote defensively later. Didn't cross my mind when I wrote that column. Then why did the column mention Israel? It dragged in the assertion that Anwar Sadat had been murdered by Muslim fanatics for his, quote, civilized attitude toward Israel, unquote. That kind of pandering reference has become so routine in Bill's writing that I can well believe he didn't remember having thought about Israel afterward. The gesture has become almost automatic. That column enraged me. It showed how insincere Bill had been all along. I should have seen it before, but I'd assumed there had been some conviction, however misguided, behind all the trouble he'd caused me, as well as other conservatives. Excuse me. Now it really sank in. He'd never meant a word of it. Everything was for public and social effect. Just as I said, what kind of figure am I cutting? How do I look to others? Did I talk well? Did I make a fine-looking face? Were all the men in love with me when they saw how beautifully I was dressed? This is WASP culture. I mean, you read Oscar Wilde, you read about how they act in England and Ireland. This is precisely the culture that Bill Buckley comes from. I don't mean literally. He didn't grow up there, but that is what they're taught. What kind of figure am I cutting? How can I show myself to best advantage? That's an obsession of the British. Obsession. Of the ones who think they're upper class. I must always, think of Diana. I mean, perfect example. This is me being compassionate, holding a little nigger baby with AIDS. Compassionate me, I like to call it. And here's me turning my face and striking exactly the right pose, getting exactly the right degree of feeling in my eyes as my professional photographer comes with me and captures me holding a little nigger baby with AIDS. I am Mother Sweetness and Light, bringing charity to the ignoble dark world. Now, this is what these people and their culture is. It's despicable. It's unmanly. It is British through and through. But his point is, again, you know, that Bill doesn't like the Jews. He's just afraid of them. Everything was for public and social effect. If the positions of Jews and Muslims were reversed, he would have written the same column about the Jews. Just like we say, you know, Congress is a bunch of whores. They don't like Israel, they're just afraid of it. And because it supplies them with money, because it's holding the carrot and the stick, they do what it wants. Now, all right, let us see here. We've been going a long time. We got a little more and we'll be done, and then we'll run a little music and have a little more of the show. Bill is always on stage. Now he's really heated up. He's I wouldn't use a knife. I'd say this is just haymaker after haymaker. Now he's just punching the fuck out of the guy's face after he's got him loosened up. He's got him loosened up from the body blows. Now he's just fucking bam, 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 going for the knockout. Bill is always on stage, always acting, posing, making empty gestures. He isn't concerned about their truth or coherence. That's why he can talk fastly about prayer while he's writing for Playboy and Penthouse. And that's why it's frustrating to read most of what he's written over the past decade or so. I wrote a column slamming him for his ugly cracks about Muslims. Then I decided the time had come to tell my side of the story about the sycophancy to the Zionist apparat. That is the state apparatus, the ZOS. When he fired me, Bill replied publicly to my account by ascribing it to, quote, an incapacitation moral and perhaps medical. That was the typical Buckley touch. He has broken with many people over the years. He's referring to his having gelded conservative race realists and Jew realists. And his standard response is to insinuate that they have become a little, you know, a little unbalanced. He himself, of course, represents the golden mean. But another way to interpret this recurrent situation with its attendant rhetoric is that the people Bill has broken with have consistently been more principled than he is. Randians, Birchers, Murray Rothbard, Wilmore Kendall, Brent Bozell, Gary Wills, and others of less renown. His only recourse is to imply that they are fanatical, extreme, obsessive, precisely the adjectives the Jews always use, from causes that are, quote, perhaps medical, unquote. Bill is an overrated debater, but he's peerless at making others look bad. So disagree with him, and it's a medical and a moral problem. That's the Jew way of doing it. That's the Soviet way of doing it, which is to say the Jewish way of doing it. I thought I'd miss National Review as an institution, but I don't. After 2 decades there, I had dear friends, but the place itself was a facade. When I signed on at the age of 26, I thought everyone there would be philosophizing and discussing first principles. There was some of that, but basically it was just a business. Nice, decent, ordinary, though intelligent people, a million laughs, and some terrifically funny guys from Jeff Hart to Ed Capano to Jim McFadden. Bill could be very funny too, of course, but even he didn't stand out in that company. What I really miss, as anyone who knows her will understand, is Dorothy McCartney. I guess she was a secretary or something, but how strangely different it all became from what I'd expected. In the 60s, when most of the world was going madly leftward in the insane pursuit of progress, so-called, Bill Buckley's conservatism seemed to many of us to be a politics appropriate to the tradition of Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, Dante, Shakespeare, and Dr. Johnson. That tradition seemed implicit in Bill himself, in his refusal to join the flow of what he mockingly called the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times. You could see in him the reflection of your own yearnings for Christianity, for constitutional government, for the free market, for the Old South, for almost every other fugitive reactionary principle. And also for the courage to stand in opposition. How all that's distantly related to the hood memory of a pious old aunt when you were a middle-aged man. Not that his life is discreditable, apart from the things I've mentioned, but somehow he belongs more to the world of Phil Donahue than the world of Dr. Johnson. His conservatism is a conservatism of image, show business, public relations, stock mannerisms, big words, and fractious grammar, repetitious Latinisms, implying a depth that is not there. What happened to him? Conservatives everywhere speculate on this. I don't fully know the answer because partly it's the mystery of his soul. All I can say is that New York, a Babylon of dizzying distractions, has absorbed him, as it is likely to absorb anyone who stays there too long, and Bill, bored with his early role, forgot what he started out to do. Gravitas was finally swallowed up in celebritas. And by now it may be necessary to stand athwart National Review, yelling, "Stop!" That's the conclusion, and that, my friends, is a fitting conservative realist, race realist, hell, just plain realist eulogy for the late, unlamented, trucklin' Bill Buckley. And with that, and it's being 4 o'clock and us 2 hours into the show, which was delayed in its start by an hour due to technical problems, let us run a couple of songs
and take a little break, and we come back, and I think we'll talk a little about global warming. Here we go. I'm going to take three or four song break here, but no more than that.
Keep going. All right. One, two, let it go.
lightning seeds. You feel like a movie star. This ain't the first time you've been grading. One change of stroke. It's baby, I'm the most. But a girl as fine as she was.
Someone to be your past, someone to
right, that was Depeche Mode with Personal Jesus, Your Own Personal. For that, we heard, what did we hear? Joe Jackson on the radio. Did we hear Jungle Work by Warren Zevon? I know we did earlier. And we heard Raspberry Beret by Prince. And we'll conclude our show with four songs to end it. But first we're going to do a... We've already been going. I get so enthusiastic about that sober and stuff, I can't shout about it. That lasted longer than I thought. We may even have to push OKC stuff back. I'm still not totally up to speed on that, although I'm prepared to talk about it today. But I think we ought to talk about global warming and the nature of scams right now. Now, global warming is all in the news and talked about by Al Gore, and everybody assumes that it's real, but... The first thing is up one of these new crusades. Oh, the earth is warming, the earth is warming, the oceans are melting, everybody's going to be under. First thing you want to say is, okay, where's the data? First of all, let's establish the facts. Don't leave and jump and run and start doing things without knowing what you're doing. Establish the facts. The fact about global warming is they've observed, they claim, you know, a portion of a degree rise in temperatures over 100 years. So, of course, immediately we must change our entire civilization, the way we do business, and have light bulbs we use, have cars we drive. Otherwise, the end of the earth is coming. This is just alarmism. There's nothing more to it than that. What it is leftists who can sell their political programs on their own value, because it's nothing but brazen and communism, decide instead they're going to trick it out and drag, and green drag, and they're going to parade it before the world in the name of the environment, and in the name of science. Things that the majority of the public still respect. Maybe Mary Baker Eddy, founder of Christian science, had a similar idea, cotton onto the Flemish science had in the late 19th century and calling her religion Christian science. So it is with Al Gore and the leftists. They're claiming in the name of science that we need to adopt their agenda and their manias in toto. And, you know, everybody take the bus to work and drive cars that don't work, put in emails. And my favorite, and I said this before, Alexander Coburn said it, I wrote it, that these carbon credits are the same thing as the selling indulgences in the Middle Ages, where, you know, you pay the priest, sometimes it allows you to commit the sin. Your sin is officially absolved. You get a sin credit from God. You're his personal representative on earth. Pastor or preacher. McFeely. You know, you go to him and you make a $200 donation to the church, and he'll let you have your way with Pierre Louis, or some young girl, or... I don't know. How many sins are there? There's a lot of different types of sins, but you can buy your way. That's the idea of this carbon stuff. If it truly is, all these things are bad in the way that they're said they're bad, then you don't need to be selling indulgences to them. You need to be copying them and finding alternatives. It's always put very moralistically. That's another sign of a scam. Anytime someone says immediate action required, that's a red flag, because most scams require immediate action. Like, let's say we're in a parking lot. This happened once, and two guys walked up. And, you know, there's been some oversight, and they have extra stock, and they accidentally have somehow this wonderful TV they're selling out of the back of their van. Another guy says, I'm not kidding. And if right now, if you buy it, right now, you know, no time to think, they will sell you this TV, which is out of sold. That's a scam. What a scam. They're going to put your door in, they're going to seal your driveway. You pay them up front, and then they take off. That trash scam, Trevor, kind of scum native to Ireland, kind of a plan. And they're in the U.S., too. There are many different scams. We saw the Jew guy down in Florida who is pretending to be a rabbi, or even in his investment offices, he's wearing his rabbi gear, and thereby tricking all the old matrons down Boca Raton into giving him their life investments, which he goes off and buys cars with and does that and the other with. Scam. All these are scams. Well, you know, when you need to move real quickly, it's always you. It's Al Gore who's needing to move quickly. You need to conform. You need to do what he says. What do I need to do? Well, you need to do the things the leftists want you to do. Do you think that's a coincidence? No, that's the main driver of the thing, is this leftist agenda. Don't want people owning cars and going to work in their own cars. The leftists always want to force them into socialized transportation. Even most people prefer to own five cars. There are times when public transportation makes sense. Subways can make some sense. But generally, they want to drive their own car. Oh, we're running out of oil. Oh, we're running out of oil. Where's the evidence? Now, there might be a little more. It was, you know, a block from here. I can get a gallon of gas for less than a gallon of milk. You know, if oil is non-renewable, and milk is renewable, why does gas cost only 3/4 of what milk costs?
if we're looking at it. You know, milk's fairly easy to get. You just use a cow. Oil takes doing to get to.
Now, let's see. I'm not sure if we're on right now or not, if it's being recorded. I was hearing from Stan, so if that's the case, I apologize. But I'm going to check that out right now. At 4:28. Anyway, what we've seen recently is that the anti-side is coming around more and start felt, and people are daring to speak up and speak back. And typically people who are on the side of global warming, what they don't understand is, well, they can see where evil corporations, as they're always talking about, have an incentive to lie about stuff. So what they can't see is where the incentive is on the part of the scientists to lie. Well, let me tell you, they've already spent $50 billion. $50 billion already disperses the global warming. With is a partial degree rise over 100 years. And when they try to prove other rises, I mean, the anti will run and look at where they place their sensors, and they find that they're placed in, they're placed in friendly locations to the case of enormous. Place where they have the temperature will be higher than it should be. Well, you know, they'll do the standard dishonesty of cutting their charts at the wrong years to make it appear it's going up. Well, guess what? Oh, we've just had news that 2007 is remarkably cool. So cool that it's even dragged that 100-year average back down to normal, which is renders the whole thing a complete joke. Here's an article. Temperature monitors report wide-scale global cooling. February 26, 2008, days ago. 12-month-long drop in world temperatures wipes out a century of warming. Over the past year, anecdotal evidence for a cool planet has exploded. China has its coldest winter in 100 years. Baghdad's the first snow in all recorded history. North America has the most snow covered in 50 years. We've certainly had more here in Missouri. Not huge amounts, but steady. It's even today it's been snow. We haven't got more than 4 inches in a time, but it's steadily snowed, and every time it melted, it would snow immediately again. With this, it's the highest since record keeping began. And I know that San Antonio is supposed to have another 7 inches tonight. Record levels of Arctic sea ice, record cold in Minnesota, Texas, Florida, Mexico, Australia, Iran, South Africa, Greenland, Argentina, Chile, the lid on. So we've been sold the last several years. And I knew that when they've been in the top 10, you know, annual temperatures, like 3-4 of them were from like it is today. And it's just, these people are lying about what's going on. And they're lying because they have a political agenda. And the agenda is the leftist agenda, the socialist agenda. It's advanced by government and media and scientists who want research money. Where there's about $50 billion already been spent on this. That's a lot of grants. That's getting a lot of people in thermometers. Right? And it's sending a lot of people there to the North Pole and, you know, shooting rubric shots of polar bear on ice floe. Nature has pattern, and that explains most of its activity, and they also further know that the sun has a lot to do with this. Behavior has little to do with it. And we're supposed to regain our way of life because of 100 degree. But if we start out of oil, what will happen is the price of oil will rise. That will be an indicator of that. And you say, that's fine. Okay, well, that's an indicator for other people to come to the market with a new solution. They're talking about the Nano, I think it is, a car in India that will basically runs on pressed air, and it takes a little bit of gas, maybe 8 gallons, and it will go 1,000 miles. And that's going to be available here in the U.S. also in a couple of years. So under $20,000 car, they'll go that far, and we'll make sick people. There's plenty of solutions out there, and they're never come up with by people like Al Gore. And as Al Gore is a champion of this, let me tell you a little bit of his background. His family was owned by Armand Hammer, who was a Jew who ran Occidental Petroleum, and he would brag about having Gore Sr., Al Gore's father, in his pocket, as his pocket congressman. And Armand Hammer did business with Soviets from the time of the Revolution all the way through the 20th century. You know, like that motion of the Cold War, I mean, we gave Russia pretty much everything they had. We sold to them. There was no revolutionaries were funded by their Jewish brethren in New York. These Jewish revolutionaries had tens of millions of dollars in bank accounts that they drew from to fund the revolution and kill the Tsar and get their people in place, establish the revolution. And they're doing all kinds of deals with their brethren over here, just like right now they're doing similar deals through Israel, through the ISI in Pakistan, into where they want to go. They're selling U.S. nuclear secrets and nuclear devices, like nuclear triggers that you need to set off nuclear weapons. So don't be fooled by the concept. This is words can occlude reality, giving a certain stability and coherence to phenomena that are basically in flux. So can nation states. Kind of have to look beneath that. I mean, yeah, oh, Germany does this, France does this. Well, look beneath the surface. What is Germany? Well, Germany is a bunch of Jews in New York dictating its position on the Holocaust. What is the U.S.? Well, the U.S. is a bunch of Jew advisors around Bush, basically giving him all his money and telling him what to do. So, don't be fooled by nations anymore than you are fooled by band words. They're used to manipulate you. Basically, there are more concepts used to manipulate you and believe things that aren't true, that are useful to the power that be, than they are reflecting reality necessarily. Only for common items where there's no incentive to deceive words you are trying to communicate. And most of the rest are used to deceive because that's what leads to profits.
I mean, I saw a direct quote, I think it was from one of the CIA directors, I think William Casey, something like, "We'll know our disinformation campaign has been successful when everything the American public believes isn't true," which is, you know, Dan Aykroyd, Israel Lincoln, Tommy Boy.
The American public doesn't know what makes it the American public.
And that's how the elites look at it. These are a bunch of dumb idiots to be lied to, and that's what global warming is. It's a campaign of lies, bent on changing U.S. behavior with the ultimate aim of protecting the big companies. It's not an anti-corporate thing at all, although it's presented that way. It's anti those who compete with the company. And it's anti-consumer. It's anti-take more taxes from white citizens, enslave them more, take more of their decisions, and take more of their money and turn it over to government. And the giant corporations, the Jewish lock, controls it. Or from you, or taken from you and given to them. When you start looking at evidence, I mean, you see that, oh, there's really nothing there. And we have, you know, talked about people who even admit it's a scam. General Motors Vice Chairman Bob Lutz has defended remarks that he made dismissing global warming as a, quote, total crock of shit. How about that? Rarely do sport leaders speak like that. And then you've also got the Weather Channel founder, John Coleman. He says about global warming, it is the greatest scam in history. I'm amazed, appalled, and highly offended by it. Global warming is scam. Disastrous science of environmental motives manipulated on scientific data to create an illusion of radical warming. Others who science the same environmental wacko type jump to the surface of support on research to further enhance the totally slanted bogus global warming claims. Their friends and governments steered huge research grants their way to keep moving going. Soon they claimed to be a consensus. And then what did they immediately do? This is another way you recognize the scam. They started acting like others, equating them with Holocaust deniers, anyone who stood up and said, we don't have evidence that global warming is happening. Tried to shut them down. Anytime someone tries to shut people down or stick them in jail, the chance that you're dealing with a scam is close to 100%. And so it is with the Holocaust. They'd stick people in jail for offering an alternative to the set of big lies that passes as the Holocaust. They throw people in jail. So we have a whole subforum dedicated to it, listing all the people from jail. And if they threw people in jail for doubting global warming, they don't quite do that yet. But they certainly go after them. Powers that be are able to inflame the little idiots, just as the conservative idiots are inflamed with the big lie of, oh, terrorists are out to get us, we need a war on terror. War on terror, global warming, there are two sides of the same coin. This side fools the liberals, that side fools the conservatives. Both are imaginary. Earth is not warming up, nor beset by Muslim terrorists. May be cooling. That's what seems to show. I hear that we're buffering some, and we may be able to play a couple more songs and just kill it right here. We've gone on fairly long today. We'll run up to the top of the hour with just some more selected music, and we'll leave the OKC for another day. Probably more talk about global warming, too, if I get my points a little better lined up. But, yeah, it is a scam, and it plays and preys on people's guilt. You know, that guilt that white people have for the third world. Oh, we're hurting the niggers. Our, you know, by going there and setting up their entire public infrastructure, we somehow hurt them in Africa. And now, you know, that we've left, they got to come up with a new, oh, we're hurting the environment. How are we hurting the environment? What hurts the intercates? And there are very good examples of that. Winning there, because the coloreds can't provide enough for themselves to eat. So they're killing everything that moves. Mugabe took all the white-owned farms and sent them over to blacks who were incapable of farming. And Zimbabwe went from the breadbasket of Africa as it is today. Well, if you're in that situation, what are you going to do? You're going to eat anything you can get your hands on. You're going to shoot any kind of wildlife. Screw wildlife. I want to live. That's the attitude blacks have because they're hungry. So think about that, liberal whites. Anyway, we'll play some music and we're out of here. That'll do it for Radio Fear of Our Lord 2008. I want to thank you for listening. My name is Alex Linder, and I'm behind GoVNN.com, VanguardNewsNetwork.com, providing you with the facts and the truth since 2000, August 9, 2000, and also VNNForum.com. We have a family of people up with solutions to the problems we describe on this show. Our name is taken from the Russian counterpart to Pravda, with this reality to use the cliche. And now we're going to play... Oy vey, I've already played a bunch of these songs. I'm going to play this song by... What do we want to play? Play one by Prince you probably haven't heard. But it's a pretty good song. I pre-listen all these. I only play stuff that I think is good. Not Messing About would be a good song to use with some of the E. Michael Jones sexual liberation stuff. Play this song, and then I'll play three... Till next time, which will probably be next Tuesday. Thanks for listening. And as always, our shows are archived, and we encourage you to take the URL and spread it. You can find a thread in VNMforum.com under our Vanguard Soul Archived on the main page at GoVNN.com. Go to the Radio Estina category,
look it up. Thanks for listening. I'm Alex Linder, and I am out of here.
I'm sorry.